Good afternoon. Now that we've all had a good lunch, hopefully we won't all fall asleep. We've heard some really good discussion or talk this morning from Fritz on resynchronization and activation of the ventricles in asynchronous contractions and stuff like that. I'm going to kind of extend some of that work and look at really the microstructure and how remodeling affects the microstructure. We also yesterday talked a little bit about, someone brought up databases, and here I look at structural variability across populations, so you can start to think of, I'll introduce some methods to look at variability within a population and across the population. So before I begin, I'd just like to acknowledge a few people that were really instrumental in this work. Ray Winslow, who's at the Institute for Computational Medicine and at Hopkins, and he's the director of the Institute and in the Department of Biomedical Engineering as well. He was originally scheduled to give this talk, and unfortunately he couldn't make it. Mike Miller at the Center for Imaging Science, and also Department of Biomedical Engineering. Elliot McVeigh at the Laboratory of Cardiac Energetics, and Fred Epstein in the Department of Radiology at UVA. So as we all know, we've heard for the last couple days that heart failure is a disease in which electrical conduction and mechanical abnormalities exist. And these effects reduce cardiac output and potentially lead for an increased risk for arrhythmias. It is a leading cause of death in the United States, and currently affects 4.7 million Americans. It's associated with poor prognosis. Approximately 1 in 5 people will die within 1 year of diagnosis. So obviously there's a need to study this. The cardiac ventricles undergo significant remodeling during the development of disease. And these remodeling can include changes in the electrophysiology. For example, alterations in genes and protein expression levels, as well as structural remodeling. We've seen gross dilation of the ventricles or thickening of the walls. You can have changes in the material properties. Does it become more fibrotic, stiffer, or more flaccid? And you can also have some alterations in the fiber structure. So I'll get into more of the structural remodeling later. Remodeling is known to impact the electrical mechanical functioning of the heart during disease. So here are some examples of remodeling in disease. Down on the bottom you see gross pathology. Here's a normal heart. And one metric that is used to quantify the disease process is termed the relative wall thickness, which is defined as the ratio of the wall thickness to chamber radius. And commonly, it's approximately 0.5. This is a value that's preserved over, has been shown to be preserved over species. So if I were to compare an elephant's heart to an infant's heart, we should see fairly similar ratio. In eccentric hypertrophy, which is due to volume overloading from such things as mitral valve regurgitation or a dysfunctional aortic valve, you can have a significant dilation of the ventricle. And so the chamber radius changes, and the wall thickness may get thinner. So this ratio can get reduced or stay fairly similar. In concentric hypertrophy, which is really a pressure overload case, if you have aortic stenosis, the ventricle walls become significantly thinner, and you can see that definitely impacts the chamber volume. So these are examples of kind of gross remodeling. But then there are other cases where, suppose you had an infarct in a particular area, you would have a thinning of the infarcted area, and you may have hypertrophy of a remote zone. So you can also have heterogeneous remodeling as well. So unfortunately, we can't, giving donuts to graduate students won't allow us to do certain types of things on them. So we use animal models to study heart failure. And there's many models to study heart failure. Pig models, canine, and murine models, and there's also many others. In this work, I'll talk about a canine model of failure. It's a dysynchronous model of failure, and it's produced by ablating the left bundle branch. If you remember back to Fritz's talk this morning, where you ablate the left bundle, and then you just follow this with tacky pacing, and what that causes is a volume overloaded case, but it's also a dysynchronous contraction. So the physiological and pathological alterations mimic those found in human dilated cardiomyopathy. Specifically, there's an elevated end diastolic volume and pressure. There's reduced contractile function, and there's this dysynchronous contraction due to the interventricular conduction defect. So here are some tagged MR images showing a normal canine heart. Unfortunately, the function on this heart is poor, but you can see that the ventricle is uniformly contracting. And here is a dysynchronous canine heart. And what you want to really look at is the septal wall is actually contracting prior to the lateral, the anterior wall. The lateral wall. So it's kind of like you squeeze down on a balloon, and that's going to distend out the lateral wall and add pre-stretch the lateral wall before it contracts. So there's an added stress on the lateral wall. So that brings me to the outline of my talk. I'm going to first review diffusion imaging techniques for high-resolution 3D reconstruction of ventricular geometry. And then I'm going to define computational methods kind of adapted from the field of computational anatomy to quantify variability of ventricular structures within a population and across populations. And specifically, I'm going to look at the dysynchronous failing heart. And then finally, I'm going to briefly discuss some future work. And for those grad students looking for dissertation topics, you might find this interesting. So our prior knowledge of ventricular fiber structure has come from histological and gross dissections. Streeter, McCollum, and Fox and Hutchins, they all showed that the fiber orientation, that the ventricles are formed by this helically wound fiber structure, and that the fiber structure on the epicardium is at a negative angle, almost, say, minus 60 degrees from that circumferential axis. And as you go transverally through the wall, the fibers are going to rotate and become more vertically aligned. So mid-wall, they're circumferentially. And they show that the fiber rotation is approximately 120 degrees. Well, later, Nielsen placed the heart on the spindle and did really detailed quantitative assessment of the cardiac fiber structure. They just kind of peeled away layers while mapping the fiber structure. And this led to better computational models of the heart. Unfortunately, all of these techniques are extremely invasive, and it really only permits measurement of projections of fiber angles. You're not going to get true fiber orientation. Diffusion tensor imaging is a technique pioneered by a fellow named Peter Basser, who's at the NIH. It's been used extensively in the brain, and it permits the non-invasive measurement of tissue structure. And the idea is that if the signal attenuation in MR images is attenuated by diffusion, and we can relate the attenuated image, S, divided by some unattenuated image, and it's linearly related to the diffusion, the log is linearly related to the diffusion effect. So diffusion tensor imaging allows us to estimate a 3x3 diffusion tensor at each imaging voxel. And it was hypothesized early on that the primary eigenvector of diffusion correlates with the long axis of the muscle fiber. So here's kind of a great rendering from the Auckland group of fibers bundling together to form sheets. And here's the long axis of the muscle fiber. So it was put forth the hypothesis that the primary eigenvector of diffusion correlates with this long axis. And over here is kind of the demonstration of that alignment. If you plot the orientation of the primary eigenvector and the orientation of the myocytes measured using histology, one is open circles and the other one is these dark circles, you can see that there's close agreement between the two as you go from the epicardium to the endocardium. In fact, if you look at the difference in angles measured using histology and those measured using this primary eigenvector, you can see that there's close agreement between the two with a standard deviation of about 15 degrees. So we developed a 3D fast spin echo diffusion sequence, and we're able to reconstruct ex vivo canine hearts at a very, very high resolution. And here's just a demonstration of that. Here's a unweighted MR image going from the apex of the heart all the way up through the ventricles and into the atrium. And over on the right side is a rendering of that primary eigenvector diffusion. And unfortunately, due to screen limits, I had to downsample this a little bit. However, what you can see is that in the bath solution, your primary eigenvector is randomly oriented, and this is typical of isotropic diffusion. In the myocardium, you can see that the eigenvectors become a lot more coherent. In fact, you see that there's this nice gradient of orientation going from the epicardium to the endocardium. So we can use this information to build up nice three-dimensional models of the geometry and the fiber architecture of the heart. And this technique allowed us to really quantify the curvature that occurs down at the apex. I want to just take a slight diversion right now. I've talked about how the primary eigenvector can measure the long axis of the muscle fibers, and it just came about yesterday in a discussion that whether it was possible to measure what's known as fiber disarray within an infarct using diffusion. And so here is an example we did a while back where we took a canine heart and infarcted it as indicated by this hyperenhancement. And then 1 week post-MI, we did a diffusion experiment on that heart, and I'm rendering the primary eigenvector of diffusion. And you can see that in the non-infarcted area, you have very coherent fibers, and that's just kind of blown up over here. And in the infarcted area, you have this less coherent fibers. They're more randomly oriented. And it was unclear whether this is, whether we're measuring true fiber disarray or whether this is just an imaging artifact associated with the inflammation process in the infarct. When you infarct something, very early on you have macrophages and a lot of water content that goes in there. And so the disarray associated with this eigenvector may simply be due to that process. So if you go back and look at how we go about computing this the diffusion tensor, how we go about estimating the diffusion tensor. Let me just quickly put up on the board the equation. If we look at the signal intensity is proportional to the diffusion rate, and within an infarcted area, the mean diffusivity increases simply because of this inflammation process. So a B is a parameter that it's an imaging parameter that remains constant. And so depending upon where we choose this imaging parameter, here I plot the variance associated with measuring D, estimating D versus the actual tissue water diffusivity. And so here's the actual tissue water diffusivity, and it ranges from 1 all the way down to 0.2. And at some given B value, or some imaging parameters B, at some constant B, you can see that depending upon the mean diffusivity, the variance on our estimated D increases. So it's quite possible that what we're seeing in the this randomness in this primary eigenvector, back on this slide, is just a function of the inflammation process and is not truly disarray. Okay, so now I want to return to, we've discussed the primary eigenvector, but there's also information contained in the secondary and the tertiary eigenvector. We've shown that the primary is aligned with the myocyte's long axis, but there's also this other structure known as laminar sheets. And this histological image is, if you just cut across perpendicular to these myocytes, you see this type of sheet structure. Well, there's reason to believe that the tertiary eigenvector, the smallest, the slowest component of diffusion, is perpendicular to the sheets. And here is sheet rendering, or let me see, it's a measurement of sheet angles measured using histology. And here's the orientation of that tertiary eigenvector for a sample heart. And you can see this was obtained from the Auckland group. And you can see that there's a fairly good similarity between the two. So it's possible that there exists a relationship between the tertiary eigenvector diffusion and the laminar sheets. Yeah?
Does the slide before that, before the one you were just showing, indicate then that you might choose a different b-value whether you were trying to characterize the fiber structure?
Yeah. So there's obviously you can play around with where you're going to image B, but it turns out there's an optimal B for the mean diffusivity that you want to measure, as you can see by these curves coming down, and then they'll skyrocket back up.
So do you know what B value you would choose if you were trying to emphasize the sheet structure instead of the fiber structure? I guess, do you know that off the top of your head, do you know the diffusivity of the sheet structure?
I haven't played with that too much. Okay, so as I was saying, that there's some indication that the tertiary eigenvector correlates with sheet structure. Unfortunately, the way we decide the way we decide whether something is the secondary or tertiary eigenvector is by we identify the tertiary eigenvector as the eigenvector whose eigenvalue is the smallest. And here on the far right, or left, I show a histogram, this bold solid line, a histogram of all the eigenvalues in a in one heart. And you can see that there's two dominant peaks. The first peak corresponds to the fastest rates of diffusion, and it is associated with the primary eigenvector. The second peak corresponds to slower components of diffusion, and it is associated with the secondary and tertiary eigenvector. And if we magnitude sort these eigenvalues, you can see that there's significant overlap between the secondary and tertiary eigenvalues. So if we sort the eigenvectors based on eigenvalue magnitude, we're going to inherently bias our tissue structure. So we need to develop methods to identify whether to properly sort these eigenvectors. And so before I go into those methods, I just want to refresh on what types of diffusion may occur. You can have isotropic diffusion, where your eigenvalues are all similar, and your eigenvectors, all three eigenvectors, are randomly oriented about a sphere. You can have transversely isotropic diffusion, where you have a single dominant direction, a single preferred direction, and your secondary and tertiary eigenvectors are uniformly distributed about the disk that's perpendicular to that long axis. Or you can have an isotropic diffusion where you have three known distinct eigenvalues, and in this case you'll have a preferred direction or orientation for that tertiary eigenvector. So ideally we would like to identify regions that are orthotropic. So we developed some hypothesis testing procedures to distinguish this anisotropic diffusion. So we broke the heart up into small ROIs, and we defined delta as the true difference in the tissue diffusivity in terms of the secondary and tertiary diffusivity, and zeta as our measured difference. And we wanted to test the null hypothesis that delta was equal to zero, meaning we want to see whether we had where we were statistically transversely isotropic. And in areas where that null hypothesis was not true, then we could identify anisotropic diffusion. So we developed two tests. One was based on the eigenvalue, distribution of eigenvalues within the ROI, and another one was based on the eigenvectors within that ROI. And you can see that this is very similar to what's known as the student t-test, except here we use the median instead of the mean, simply because our eigenvalues are Rayleigh distributed, or very similar to Rayleigh distribution. And the R-test is basically testing the uniformity of the eigenvectors on the depth, on the disk. This is very similar to the Smirnov test. So then we went about characterizing these two types of tests, and for the sake of time, I won't go into too much detail, but the upshot was that the t-test, the one that's based on the eigenvalue distribution within the ROI, is actually more optimal for this procedure, simply because it is less sensitive to the mean diffusivity within an ROI, and it actually has the power of the t-test is fairly significant when your the uncertainty in the secondary eigenvector is fairly low. So this becomes important later on, and if you want to look more into that, you can just look at that reference. So then we went through each of the hearts, and we imaged a whole population of hearts and broke them up into ROIs. We broke them up into five ROIs transmurally and a whole bunch in various areas, and we want to see, and we applied this t-test to those various areas, and we found that statistically we had anisotropic diffusion in areas between the subepicardium and endocardium, which may be an indication of the sheath structure. So then within these areas, we then looked at the tertiary eigenvector of diffusion, the orientation of this tertiary eigenvector, and here I show within the apical region, going transmurally, I plot the distribution of angles of that tertiary eigenvector associated with two hearts. Each one is colored a different color, and you can see that in each area, or in each ROI, there existed a dominant orientation for this tertiary eigenvector, and that dominant angle was different for the two different hearts. If you go ahead and pool these tertiary eigenvectors from a population of hearts, you'll see that there's two real dominant angles that this tertiary eigenvector can take, and that these angles are approximately 45 degrees and 135 or so degrees. And in the epicardium, we experienced because we had mostly transversely isotropic diffusion, there wasn't very good tissue structure there. So this kind of correlated very well with the work of Theo Arts, who used numerical models and then pooled some histological measurements of sheath structure and showed that there were really two possible orientations for sheath structure, one at approximately 45 degrees, and here is a nice rendering of how that sheath structure would look like, and another one at approximately 135 degrees. So there's close agreement between the two, and so the tertiary eigenvector appears to be a good indication of sheath structure. Okay, I want to take a slight diversion and talk about how we can improve visualization of tensors using glyphs. This work was pioneered by Gordon Kindleman and Dan Ennis, who's here. And the idea is that visualization will help us understand what's the underlying structure. So we use these, there's a whole spectrum of shapes that we can define for a diffusion tensor. If we have isotropic diffusion, you can think of a sphere. If you have transversely isotropic diffusion, or where there's one large eigenvalue and the second two are similar, you can define that as a transversely isotropic diffusion. On the other end, you can have the two larger eigenvalues similar and the smallest eigenvalue very small. You can have a very disc-like shape. And within this realm of shapes, you can have orthotropic diffusion, where you have three distinct eigenvalues. Well, it turns out that the use of superquadratic glyphs actually enhances our ability to see what's going on in the tensors. And the idea is that the edges, if there are differences in the eigenvalues, then we will develop sharper edges to these objects. So you can see that we have transversely isotropic diffusion, and orthotropic diffusion, where you have very sharp edges on all three faces. So now the idea is, when we're looking in myocardium, if we have a sheet-like structure, you're going to be very you'll have orthotropic diffusion. In the epicardium, you may have more uniaxial diffusion or equal biaxial diffusion. So there's a whole spectrum of shapes that you can have, and we'll use these shapes to start looking at the structure. So here are visualization of the transmural variation of tensors. Here using ellipsoids going from the epicardium to the endocardium, and I color the ellipsoids according to the fiber orientation. And you can see that we have transversely isotropic ellipsoids here, and we become more anisotropic as you go to the endocardium. Unfortunately, ellipsoids don't give us that edge information. These superquadratic glyphs actually give us a better understanding of the structure, underlying structure. And you can see right in here we start to have very orthotropic diffusion. Again, you have isotropic diffusion on the epi and in parts of the papillary muscle. Yep.
Could that be the reason of the imaging?
Excuse me?
More accurate? I see the ellipsoids to be better defined on the epi because of the end.
As opposed to the end?
Yeah.
What do you mean better defined?
More elongated.
Yeah.
And the fibers are, we all know, the change direction. Why are they not similarly shaped?
Well, on the endocardium, we know that there's a lot of sheet structure going on in the endocardium, so we would expect them to become more orthotropic and not very transversely or cylindrical like on the endocardium.
And again, how does that explain the fact that the inner wall moves a lot compared to the outer wall?
Well, we have the sheet structure is there, and Theo can answer this better, but there's a lot of slippage between these sheets. Whereas in the epicardium, you don't have that well-defined sheet structure. And so as you contract, you're getting the wall thickening through this slippage of the sheets on the epicardium.
Not the inner undulations. The fact that the wall inside is more nice and smooth. It's a little roughly. Maybe are you getting a reflection of that?
The
inner wall is more smooth.
The inner wall. The endocardium is not smooth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you're giving a reflection of that in the convention.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
I think if you had a voxel that contained, in the example of the imaging experiments here, if you had an endocardial voxel and it contained isotropic fluid and anisotropic fluid, that you would still be able to extract within, assuming you have relatively good signal to noise, you would still be able to extract that anisotropic information. And the resolution of Pat's experiments are well below the millimeter level. 350 microns in plane, so I think it's pretty easy to delineate between sort of the trabecular tissue and the sort of blood pool inside.
So you're not just blind averaging trabecular pieces with each other then?
I don't think there's very
Okay, so here's an example rendering the glyphs in the RV insertion point. And you can see that we have some transversely isotropic diffusion going through a whole spectrum, getting more orthotropic. And here we're looking at a papillary insertion area. And so on the epicardium, you're very transversely isotropic. You've got this nice gradient going to orthotropic. And then as you get back up into the papillary muscle, you see things become very transversely isotropic again. And if you just take a cut perpendicular to that, so here's the same papillary muscle, except we're doing a perpendicular cut on the epicardium. Again, you're seeing transversely isotropic, getting very orthotropic within the midwall, and then you start to become more transversely isotropic as you get back out to the papillary muscle. So glyphs have really enhanced our ability to see the underlying structure and really look at these tensors. Go ahead.
So those kind of spatial relationships, are they
do these patterns differ depending upon
where you are in
where
the
where you are in the
Yeah, you can in various regions, as I was showing you, you do see different variation in these glyph shapes. In general, though, on the epicardium, you have transversely isotropic diffusion, and as you go more to the endocardium, you become very orthotropic. So we can apply diffusion, this 3D diffusion imaging sequence to a whole population of hearts, and you can see that there is variation in the structure just within a population of normal hearts, but there's also variation in structure across a normal and a failing heart. We can also look at variation in the fiber orientation. So we imaged a whole bunch of hearts, normal and failing, and the failings are these asynchronous hearts. We also looked at some normal and infarcted hearts. And for those working on computational models, you can download these data sets at this site. So in order to start looking at population variation, we need to put everything into a common coordinate system. And the method for doing that is we want to register these anatomies. So we first resample all the hearts in our population to a common resolution. And then from that population, we're going to select an arbitrary template and then match all the remaining hearts in that population, we term them targets, to that template. And so that template becomes our common reference frame from which we're going to look at variation. And so you can think of first rigidly rotating and translating a template. So we're going to take the template and deform it out and define a mapping of that template to the patient. So we first rigidly rotate and translate that template so that it's roughly aligned with a particular target. And then we compute a high order transformation such that every voxel in the template matches to a voxel in the target. And here's just an example coordinate transformation. You have some rigid body rotation translation, and then you apply this high order transformation to that coordinate system such that our deformed template anatomy now corresponds to the target anatomy. So we compute this high order transformation using a technique known as the large deformation diffeomorphic metric mapping method developed out of Mike Miller's group and worked on by Faisal Beg. And the idea is that if we define I naught as our template and I1 as our target, we want to define the transformation such that at time t equals zero, the position x on the template maps through time to the position phi of x at time t equals one on the target. And this mapping proceeds through this kind of normalized time coordinate. And at every coordinate, you can think of phi as a displacement vector, displacement map. And at any time point along here, that particle x has a certain velocity associated with it. And the nice things about these transformations that they're invertible and smooth and one-to-one, and they're computed by the minimization of a cost function. And the cost function really has two terms. One is the difference between the deformed template and the target anatomy. And the second one constrains the smoothness of this velocity vector field. And this velocity vector field is constrained to satisfy Euler-Lagrange equations of mechanics. Another thing that's nice is that the target anatomy can be uniquely described by the template anatomy and that initial trajectory at which we're going to start to deform a particle. And this will become important later on when we start to look at population variation. And I just want to highlight that the time, this normalized time coordinate system, is not what we think of cardiac phase. Everything is in diastole here. So here's a demonstration of mapping a normal heart to a failing heart. So we first rigidly matched this normal heart to the failing heart, and then we used LDMM to compute an initial velocity such that when I apply this velocity and march through time, I will deform this normal heart into the failing heart. And here's just that movie depicting that. So I'm going from time t equals zero, where I'm at the normal heart position, and evolving through time to time t equals one, where I'm now at the failing heart position. And again, these transformations are invertible, so I can go in any which direction. Well, we can now start to think of averaging two geometric configurations, and here's how we would go about doing that. If we had two target anatomies, or two patients, and we wanted to figure out what is the mean geometry between these two patients, if we define the anatomy as I1 and I2, patient 1 and patient 2, simply adding I1 and I2 and dividing by 2 is not going to get us a mean geometric configuration. But we can use the LDMM method to compute an initial velocity such that when I apply this velocity to the template and evolve through time, I can compute an estimation of my target heart 1. And I can do the same thing for target heart 2. I compute, using LDM, an initial velocity such that when I apply this velocity to the template anatomy, evolve through time, I compute target heart number 2, an estimation of target heart number 2. Well, I can then average these two velocity vector fields, apply it to the template, evolve through time, and compute an average geometric configuration that resides between these two patients. We can extend this further for a whole population of hearts. So here I just depict a population of 6 hearts, and we arbitrarily choose one of our hearts as our starting template. And then we're going to map this template to each of the hearts in the population as depicted by those green arrows. And then we look to see what the mean velocity vector field is for this population. And we're going to evolve our template anatomy in the direction of that mean velocity vector field. And we iterate this process until our mean velocity vector field is 0. And when once that occurs, our template anatomy is now residing within the middle of all the geometric configurations within that population. So this is an estimation of the mean geometry for that population of hearts. Good.
In the calculation of the registration of this mean, it was clear to me how one can do it when you're operating with scalar value data.
Yep.
But it was not clear to me whether you are applying the substitution as data
Yeah, so right now it's all scalars. We're just looking at the imaging data, or the intensity information. I'll talk about the carrying over that diffusion tensor information a little later. Go ahead.
How do you get your initial estimate about correspondence?
How do I get my what?
Initial estimate.
So the initial estimate is defined by a few a sparse set of landmarks. So
user defined or?
Yes, user defined. That. So now that we have this Procrustes mean, or the mean geometry for that population, we can compute variation about that mean by using something called the principal component analysis on the velocity vector fields. Here is a rendering of a single slice of the template anatomy, and I'm just rendering a particular initial velocity vector field that's going to deform into a particular heart. So each heart has a velocity vector field associated with it. We can compute the covariance matrix of all these vector fields and look at the eigenvectors or eigenvalues associated with these velocity vector fields. And then we can look at variation by evolving the hearts in the direction of this principal component, principal eigenvector of the vector fields, if that makes sense. So it turns out these vector fields, for every voxel, you define a vector of motion. And so because these hearts are imaged at such a high resolution, you can have your covariance matrix can be on the order of 6 million by 6 million. So it's extremely large covariance matrix. And so it becomes very difficult to invert this problem. But if you look at, you can rewrite this covariance matrix. If we define the velocity vector field where 3 represents x, y, z, each vector, and you have n number of pixels for a particular heart by n number of patients, we can look at v transpose v, compute the eigenvalues and eigenvectors for this system. And depending upon, this becomes an n by n matrix and becomes much easier to compute the eigenvalues and eigenvectors for this system. And it turns out that the eigenvalues for this larger matrix are a scaled version of the eigenvalues for the smaller matrix. So here is some results summarizing using principal component analysis in that normal population. Here is the atlas heart, and I can deform that atlas heart, or the mean geometry for the normal population, and I can deform that atlas in the direction of highest geometric variation for that normal population. And you can see that we can deform in the positive direction of that variation or the negative direction. You can kind of think of this as the mean and then one standard deviation and a minus standard deviation. And you can see that as we within the normal population, the RV insertion point is fairly variable. We can do the same thing for the failing population. If this is our mean geometry, we can deform the anatomy in the direction of highest geometric variation for the failing population. And in the failing population, we found that the wall thickness was highly variable, and the chamber volume was also variable, as well as what's also neat is that the in the failing population, the apex becomes very spherical. And I'll talk about this a little bit later. We can also look at between a normal heart and a failing heart, you just get this gross dilation. So here's just a graphical rendering of that whole spectrum going from starting at a mean heart and just evolving through the spectrum of geometric shapes found within that population. And I could look at this all day. It's kind of neat. You can see that the RV insertion point is highly variable here in the normal population. In the failing population, you do have some variability of that RV insertion point. Notice how the chamber dilates, gets very large, and then the wall becomes progressively thinner in that failing heart. Yep?
Again, this seems to be dependent on your model. This is the pacing model, right?
Yeah.
And so,
so this is.
If you come on an in-park model where you're creating posterior in-parks or anterior in-parks, it's going to be totally different.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. It depends upon the model, and this is just the synchronous model of Kelly.
Can I ask you, do you have science there on particular, on purpose in there? Because you said earlier you do a rigid registration followed by a non-rigid registration. So you basically don't throw out the scale component. And it looks like you have a big scaling there between.
Oh, yeah. So I do throw out the scaling component.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So simply, here in this mean here is not the mean for the failing population, but represents the mean, the Procrustes mean for the normal population. I'm just evolving that Procrustes mean for the normal population in the failing direction.
So your rigid transformation doesn't include a global scale in that?
It does. Isotropic scale. So I've talked about registering just the gross anatomy, but now we have all this fiber structure information. And we would like to start to look at the variability in the fiber structure. Unfortunately, we can't, the proper way to do this is, because we have this higher order deformation, there you need to reorient this diffusion tensor. So there's really two ways to go about doing this. And that is transform the diffusion tensor with the Jacobian of the transformation. Or we can first reference the fiber architecture to the geometry so that when the geometry deforms, we can maintain that scalar information in fiber architecture. And I use this technique for our analysis. So here are kind of a summary slide of the results that we found in the remodeling desynchronous heart. There I looked at the relative wall thickness, and I'm color coding the atlas heart according to the mean relative wall thickness for the population of normals. And you can see for the population of normals, there's a uniform distribution of relative wall thickness. There's a slight increase here, and I think that was due to contouring of the hearts down toward where the RV inserted into the OE. In the failing population, this again is the desynchronous failing population, you can see that the septum becomes significantly thinner, and there was some hypertrophy of the lateral wall. And these two walls were found to be statistically different, but also note that we have significant differences between the normal and failing. And this difference was due to this desynchronous contraction. The septal is contracting prior to the lateral wall. In terms of the fiber orientation, we didn't find any statistical changes in gross fiber orientation. It went from approximately minus 60 degrees to plus 60 degrees in both the normal and the failing population. However, if you couple that result with the fact that we have significant thinning of the lateral wall, you can see that the fiber gradient becomes significantly increased. And in terms of the laminar structure, we found obviously two populations of sheets, one at 45 degrees and one at minus 45 degrees, and I'm rendering the dominant angle for that region. And we found was in the going between the normal and the failing population, there was a significant reorientation of that laminar structure, so that it became a lot steeper in that failing population. And that may be attributed to this thinning of the wall. These sheets just kind of reorient each other. So I want to extend this a little further. One thing that we haven't talked about is something called the transverse angle. And the group out of the Netherlands found that the transverse angle is the angle that the fiber makes relative to the epicardial surface. So it imbricates in transmurally. And they found that the imbrication angle is extremely important in reducing the circumferential radial shear that occurs at the apex. And so using these computational methods, I look at the imbrication angle associated with a normal heart and that associated with the population of failing hearts. And I found that down at the apex of the normal population, we have very large imbrication angles, and they're actually very small as you go closer to the base. And this correlates with some of the findings that these people found. In the failing population, we didn't see as severe of imbrication angles in that population. And this may be attributed to the fact that in the failing population, the apex becomes very spherical, and you may not need this very large imbrication angle to reduce the circumferential radial strain. And I'm just going to divert a little bit more and investigate this a little further. One way to look at the primary eigenvector structure is using a method called using fiber tracking algorithms. And the idea is that for every voxel, we have a primary eigenvector of diffusion. And we can define a pathway that starts in a particular voxel. And as we march through the voxels, we grow these pathways in the direction of the primary eigenvector through each of the voxels. This is just a sample of fiber tracking results in the rat brain from Susumu Mori's group, where you can see they've defined using diffusion tensor imaging, they've identified these nice pathways in the brain. Well, we can apply, I'm just watching time here, we can apply similar results to fiber tracking in the heart, similar techniques. And so here's just gross fiber tracking of the ventricles with all this data that we have. And there's something that is really, I would like to highlight. In the apex, if we seed a particular location on the endocardium and track those fibers, you'll see they break right out to the epicardium. So they start on the endocardium and break out to the epicardium. And that's due to this transverse angle. Similarly, if we look up at the base of the heart, if we start on the endocardium, they'll break out to the epicardium. And so it seems like there's this nice continuous path going from the endocardium down at the apex, breaking out to the epicardium, coming up on the epicardium, and coming back down, traversing down onto the endocardium at the base. So it seems like this, we have this nice continuous loop. Terence Guasp, using gross dissections, kind of alluded to this. And here's just a rendering of, it's not a rendering, it's a picture of his gross dissection. And you can kind of see how the primary fiber structure comes out and winds back into the endocardium down toward the apex. So it was great to look at these fiber pathways, but we wanted to get a better quantitative assessment of what's going on. So here, again, I took a heart and I identified a voxel on the endocardium and applied fiber tracking from that voxel. And you can see that the fiber pathways wind around the heart out toward the epicardium and then back into the endocardium. And you can see, starting at that voxel, we wind up to the base of the heart and then wind back down on the epicardium and then back into the endocardium. So you can see this kind of continuous helix that goes around the heart. So here is kind of a rendering of what may be going on. You have this nice figure of eight where you have this inclination angle on the epicardium. You have an opposite inclination angle on the endocardium, and you can form these continuous loops around the entire ventricle. And so the ventricle on the endocardium is red, the epicardium is blue, so that there's this continuous looping of these vectors. Yeah, question?
That's a beautiful figure up on the top left, and that double loop is very nice. Wasp also talks about a double loop.
Yeah.
But his double loop is the LV and the RV, and yours is strictly in the LV.
Yeah, Wasp had this whole concept of being able to unravel the RV into the LV and et cetera. I'm not sure we're able to see that with vector tracking pathways, and it's really unclear what this septation that he is using to defy those planes. But I just simply showed that slide because it's a nice gross dissection where you see this kind of wrapping effect underneath. And whether you can peel off the RV and unfold the entire LV, I don't know. Right, exactly. I guess I didn't make that clear. What we're looking at in diffusion, we have many, many, many myocytes and within a voxel, and we're just looking at grossly the orientation of that collection of myocytes, and we're not looking at a single myocyte linking to another myocyte.
So what Florent Blass did was he boiled these hearts for ages, and then he found that he could somehow kind of tease them apart into this big long strip.
People have been doing this, you know, wall for centuries, literally, you know, heart results, like the boiling hearts and vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, you can push your finger along almost anyway, because it is sort of a incision, and it's not like real fishing line or something, which you actually go through.
Yeah, so that's why diffusion imaging allows us to non-invasively probe this without destroying the tissue.
Where's the central circumferential part?
So that's one thing I haven't mentioned, and when tracking these fiber pathways, I only see the epicardium and I only see the endocardium. If I see the midwall, I will develop fiber pathways that just buzz around and keep looping and looping and looping. So and it crashes my computer. So I've eliminated circumferential fibers. By simply seeding the epicardium and the endocardium.
You put a stopping rule when you're going around and try multiples of bed pie.
Yeah, well, so that brings me to my next thought, is we can look at the periodicity of these pathways. So looking at this one, you can see that we take a full pi, 4 pi periodic going from the epi to the endo, apex to the base. So if we look at the periodicity of all these pathways from a whole collection of 5 different hearts, you can see that there's a periodicity at 2 pi, but there's also another periodicity at 4 pi, which is indicative of this nice continuous looping effect. Now, the broadness of this effect may depend upon the steepness of the imbrication angles that we see. If we at very, very large imbrication angles, you may not need a complete 4-pi loop. This is just something I was messing around with trying to understand why this fiber structure developed. I just created a simulation where I wanted to develop a pathway that touched the epicardium once and had that minus 60 degrees on the epicardium pass through the endocardium with that known plus 60 degrees on the endocardium and simply minimize the bend energy in that pathway. And it turns out as we minimize the bend energy, you form this nice complete helix. What this has, says mechanically in terms of these pathways, I have no idea, but I just thought that was quite interesting, that from. Okay, so now I'll finally just kind of conclude with a few future applications of computational anatomy. So far I've discussed mapping, scalars, and carrying diffusion tensor information across that mapping, but we can start to think about advancing our techniques to simply map the eigenvectors and use the eigenvector or tensor information to drive the mapping. We can start to think about all the work that I've done is all in one particular cardiac phase in diastole. we can start to think of adding another dimension to this and mapping through time and using CINAHL information to do that mapping. And we can also map mechanical function from tagged information, tagged MRI, or dense MRI. So here's just here's the old mapping technique that is driven by the intensity of the template and the target information. We can modify this equation so that what drives the mapping is the eigenvectors, matching the primary eigenvectors. And Yan Chow in Mike Miller's group showed how to go about using the vector information to drive the mapping. And here's some of her initial results, where you have one heart in, shown in blue, and another heart shown in red. This is showing the final overlap of the two hearts. And here we're looking at the dot product of the two eigenvectors from one heart and the eigenvectors from the other heart. And the color code is red if the dot product is 1, and 0 if they're not, or if they're orthogonal. And you can see, for the most part, these eigenvectors can overlay. So we can use eigenvectors to, or the fiber architecture, to drive these mappings. So that is the just simply using a vector to drive the mappings. But you can start to think of modifying this to not just use the primary eigenvector to drive the mapping, but the full tensor to drive the mapping. And finally, we can use diffeomorphisms on this time-evolving CINAHL data, or take the tag data, look at the strain, and use the strain vectors or the strain tensors to drive these diffeomorphisms. Start to look at what functional changes are that occur in a population. And here is just a rendering of the dense displacement vectors obtained using dense MRI. And I color code the strain vectors according to their, I color code the displacement vectors according to their strain. And it turns out this is a desynchronous heart, where you can see an area of inactive myocardium and active myocardium. So both tagged and dense MRI gives us a lot of functional information. We can start to think of using this information and looking at variation of contraction in disease. And with that, I'll conclude. But hopefully the take-home message is that modern imaging techniques, both MRI, tagging, dense, diffusion, that coupled with computational methods are giving us great insight into remodeling in disease.